Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of May. The sixth extinction. There have been five great die-offs in history, and this time the cataclysm is us. The current issue of The New Yorker magazine has a fascinating article by our guest the first hour. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. She's worked for the magazine for 10 years. And her stories include political profiles, book reviews, comment pieces, and extensive writing on climate change. You may remember her three-part series on global warming, The Climate of Man, which won a number of awards. She came to The New Yorker from The New York Times, is also author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Elizabeth. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you care to use the email address, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. This very, very interesting article took you to many parts of the earth, didn't it? You went to some pretty remote locations.
Yeah, it was actually, you know, parts of it were a lot of fun. Parts of it were pretty gruesome.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure they were. Do you want to start by just telling us where you traveled, and then we'll get into what you saw where you traveled? You were in Panama. You looked at bats bats that were dead in various parts of the world.
Right. Well, I was in Panama. We went looking for frogs. There's been a wave of extinctions of amphibians in Central America and actually in many, many parts of the world. And right now, here in the Northeast where I live, there's been a tremendous die-off. I'm sure your readers have read about it, your listeners have read about it, of bats, ordinary sort of bats that we see flying around in the summer. And I went with some scientists to places where bats hibernate in the Northeast and in the Midwest. Bats hibernate over the winter, and there were just, you know, dead bat carcasses everywhere in these bat, I guess we would call them bat caves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very, very, both of them are very sad stories.
They sure are sad stories. You cite some remarkable statistics in the article. Of the many species that have existed on Earth, estimates run as high as 50 billion. More than 99% have disappeared.
Well, life on Earth has, you know, a very long history, you know, billions of years, and complex life has been around now for, you know, 500 million years or more, and many, many species in that time have come and go. Species tend to have a lifetime. No one's exactly, you know, sure exactly what it is, but let's say on the order of a million years. In that time, in 500, you know, million years, many, many species have evolved and then died out.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the controversy concerning the great die-offs in history, whether or not, how they happened, how Darwin thought, well, it's kind of a big question here, what Darwin thought about this, how scientists have disputed how these extinctions took place.
Right. Well, as, you know, extinction is a concept, even as a concept, came into being basically in the early 19th century, and it was very controversial at the time. There was a sort of a, you know, theological view of life, that God created life, and why would God create a species, you know, only to do it in? It didn't really seem to make a lot of sense. And at that time, right around the turn of the, you know, right around 1800, slightly before, people were discovering a lot of, you know, very amazing fossils. Thomas Jefferson was quite interested in this. He had a fossil collection, I believe, and it was clear from some of these fossils that, you know, these things didn't seem to be around. No one, or if they were around, no one knew where they were. But at that point, a lot of the world was sort of unexplored, at least by Westerners still. So when Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out, for example, he thought maybe they would, you know, find mastodons out there. It's a big country, you know. You know, Europeans hadn't been to a lot of it. Maybe they were out there. And, you know, but there was a French scientist in Paris named Georges Cuvier, very, you know, famous in biological circles, and he, he sort of said, well, I don't buy that. You know, we look at these fossils and we have explored enough of the world to know, you know, there aren't mastodons roaming around anymore. And he sort of introduced this concept of extinction. Things do go extinct. Species come into being, and then they die off. And it was quite controversial, but it seemed to make a lot of sense. The more that you looked into the fossil record, the more you sort of had to acknowledge, look, these things are not around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So extinction became, you know, recognized as a fact. It also still was tied up in a lot of theological thinking. You know, Noah's flood had done away, perhaps, with many species. But when Darwin came along, so extinction was, you know, sort of recognized and on some level, I don't want to say understood, but recognized as part of the fossil record. But it was very perplexing to people because you could see in the record when you dig down that you reach certain points in the fossil record where the types of organisms seem to change very dramatically, you know, in a very sudden sort of way. And what Darwin decided when he was coming up with his theory of natural selection was that just indicated, and he had some predecessors in the geology world who had sort of told him that this was the case. Okay, there's just something wrong with the fossil record. You know, there's actually was a lot of time elapsed, but it's just missing from the record. So what looks like a very sudden change is not a very sudden change. And that's what he believed, and he was very firm on that. He said extinction takes place very slowly, even more slowly than speciation. But then, you know, and people believed that for a very long time. Well, extinction takes place very slowly, even as more and more evidence accumulated, for example, about the event at the end of the Cretaceous 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs died. More and more evidence seemed to suggest that happened rather quickly. And then, not until 1980, did we get this sort of breakthrough moment in the history of science, really, when some scientists from Berkeley, Walter Alvarez, Louis Alvarez, came up with a theory that is now very widely accepted, that an asteroid hit the Earth at 65 million years ago, ended the Cretaceous in this huge asteroid impact and caused massive extinction. And that caused people to really rethink extinction. Extinction on a massive scale can happen very quickly, it turns out. And looking back in the fossil record, people now identify sort of two dozen moments when mass extinctions, what are called mass extinctions, have occurred, and then there are five moments that they've identified, which are called the Big Five, where really massive extinctions have occurred. And the most recent one was this end Cretaceous asteroid.
Mm-hmm. And there may be one that we're in right now.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think the evidence is pretty clear that we are in mass extinction, an extinction that will, you know, show up in the geological record as unusually large. Now, whether we are in a Big Five kind of moment or not, you know, that remains to be seen. But we are in some kind of an unusual extinction event. We are wiping out, you know, many, many more species than a sort of background extinction rate would imply. And, you know, I think that's pretty clear, and I think most biologists would agree with that.
And you concentrate on the frogs and the bats because that's where the most dramatic die-offs are taking place, Elizabeth?
Exactly. I mean, those are just examples. You know, there are many organisms at the edge of extinction right now, many about which, you know, to be honest, we probably don't even have enough data. But frogs and amphibians are crashing in a way that's just very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. And they're crashing rapidly, aren't they? Tell the frog story. You go into great detail in the article, but in some cases, just in a matter of a short period of time, frogs just were abundant, and there was a little town that sold all these frog souvenirs, and all of a sudden, the frogs are gone.
Yes, exactly. It was just, and before people sort of, you know, figured out what appears to be the causality, it was just very mysterious. Suddenly the frogs would be gone, exactly. And, you know, amphibians are not that well monitored, so in some places they crashed without anybody noticing it, but then in some places they crashed, and they were, you know, so commonplace and so sort of beloved, like the Panamanian golden frog, that people did take notice.
Mm-hmm. And you went on this journey. Where was the journey where various species of frogs were marked?
Were marked. We went to sort of central Panama, a national preserve, a national forest, national park, I guess, and we looked for frogs. We didn't mark them. We took samples of what was on their skin, and those are then taken back to a lab for analysis to see if this fungus, which is what is now seems to be causing a lot of these very precipitous crashes, to see whether the frogs were infected.
And the fungus is called chytrids. Tell me more about it.
Yeah, it's a form of a very common, ubiquitous kind of a fungus. Not a fungus like, you know, like a mushroom, but a microscopic, you know, microorganism of the fungal fungal order. And chytrid fungi are everywhere. You know, they're in your house, they're in your lawn. But this is a particular species that is capable. It's believed that it interferes. Frogs have very permeable skin, and that it interferes with the frog's electrolyte balance, and eventually actually causes them to have a heart attack. That's the way it's believed that they die. So this fungus, I mean, it has a very interesting story. No one knows exactly where it came from, but the best theory that we have is that it was on frogs that were exported out of South Africa during the 40s and 50s for pregnancy tests. They used to inject these frogs, African clawed frogs, with urine, I guess it was, which if you were pregnant, if the woman was pregnant, the frog would lay eggs. So it was a very early, you know, very primitive pregnancy test, but it worked pretty well. And so thousands of these frogs were exported all around the world.
Oh my.
It's believed that this particular kind of frog can withstand this fungus, perhaps has lived with it for, you know, thousands of years. We don't know. But as it moved around the world, it hit places where frogs could not deal with it, and they got infected and spread it around. That's the belief.
Uh-huh. And the same thing with the bats?
Well, the bats are also being killed off by a fungus, interestingly enough, coincidentally enough. I don't know that there's any grand conclusion you can draw from that. No one knows where this fungus came from, but it is quite possible, I think even people would say likely, that it was brought into a place that bats were hibernating by people, and it spreads very, very rapidly. And the interesting thing about this fungus is it can only live in the cold. So it's not a fungus that, you know, presumably was meant to live off of or coexist with mammals, because mammals, you know, maintain a high body temperature unless they're hibernating. And when bats hibernate, or dead, I should add, and when bats hibernate, it's a fascinating thing. They drop their body temperature very, very low. Most animals, even when they hibernate, still maintain a high body temperature. But bats actually go into sort of, you know, nearly cryogenic state. And when you see them in these bat caves where they're hibernating, they actually have frozen ice crystals on them often. So they really have a low body temperature, and this fungus can attack them. This fungus, which lives in the cold, attacks them while they're hibernating, and they're very, very vulnerable at that moment. They have to get through the winter on no food, and so they sort of wake up. Something about this fungus irritates them. They wake up out of their hibernation. They fly around, and either, no one is sure, they either starve to death because they use up their fat reserves, or they die of the cold. We're just not sure. But I have seen the places where they're just, you know, piled up, thousands, really tens of thousands of bat corpses.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Elizabeth, and we'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Elizabeth's piece runs in the New Yorker this week, reporter at large, The Sixth Extinction. There have been five great die-offs in history. This time, the cataclysm is us. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our lines are pretty filled, but just keep the number in mind, and you'll be able to get through eventually. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Wednesday, the purpose of boys, helping our sons find meaning, significance, and direction in their lives. Michael Gurian will be joining us. Let's go to phone calls for Elizabeth, and we start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest.
Good morning.
In 1950, there were 150 million people in this country. Now we have 300 million. In 1950, there were 2.5 billion people on the face of the earth. Now we've got 6 billion headed towards 7. Our population needs to stabilize, and we are consuming the earth.
Elizabeth, you talk about population in the article.
Yes, I do talk about population, and I mean, the caller is absolutely right. There's been, you know, just explosive human population growth over the last several decades. It hasn't leveled off yet, and that obviously has tremendous impacts on the earth. You know, all of us have a, you know, even those of us living, you know, the most modest lives, and many people, and, you know, many billions of people on the world are not living the way we are here in the States. But we have a footprint, you know, that we are competing with other organisms, and on some level it just makes sense that if we are eating and, you know, using the resources of the ocean and cutting down the forest, that we are displacing other organisms. It's sort of hard to argue with that.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the article about what happened with extinctions almost immediately after human beings set foot on places like Australia. What's the connection between the human population and the reasons for extinction once humans arrived?
Well, that's a very interesting and sort of much debated question. What you're talking about is something that has a phenomenon that has its own name. It's called first contact extinctions. And if you sort of trace human migration around the world into places like Australia, and then, which was a very long time ago, say 50,000 years ago, and then into North America, and then, you know, into many islands, the Hawaiian Islands, New Zealand, places like that, you can see, once again, in the fossil record, and in some cases, these, you know, it's not even in the fossil record, it's simply, you know, sort of lying around, evidence that there were huge extinctions right around the time that people arrived. And I think, you know, for many years it was sort of debated what is the reason for this, but it's, I think, become pretty clear and pretty widely agreed that humans are the cause of these extinction waves. They're just, you know, in each place where you go, they occur, you know, right around the same time. And then the question is, well, what is the mechanism? How did humans kill off, you know, so many different organisms, especially large organisms? There were a lot of, you know, large mammals on this planet before humans began moving around. We know, you know, people have heard of, you know, the mammoths and the mastodons and the saber-toothed cats that were on this continent. And no one really knows exactly how humans might have managed to do in all these organisms, because there weren't, you know, that many of us at that point. So one theory is that, you know, people just changed the landscape. They came in and they might have burned the landscape, for example, to flush out prey, let's say, as part of hunting because they weren't farming yet, and that this just changes the landscape, and some organisms can survive that, and those are the organisms that are around now, and some can't, and those are the organisms that we no longer have.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, for your call. We go to Mike next from Grant County. Hi, Mike. Mm-hmm. Mike, are you there? All right, let's go to Kyle from Waukesha. Hi, Kyle.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a question. I just joined in, but I didn't hear. I don't really hear people talk about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, 100 miles north of Hawaii. And I was just curious on what the effects on species that has.
That's a good question. What the caller is referring to is this. What's something that's called the Pacific Gyre, which is this huge area. My understanding, I don't want to pretend to be an expert on this in any way, where there's just this huge, for having to do with the way that the water, you know, circulates in the world, where a lot of just debris, just junk, has gotten concentrated, and is, you know, miles and miles, hundreds of square miles, where, you know, there's more plastic, you know, broken down tiny little fragments of plastic than there is, you know, plankton in the water. And it's, you know, I think believed to be quite devastating for marine life, but I honestly don't know, you know, to what extent there are organisms that are threatened with extinction because of this Pacific garbage patch, but it is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Kyle. Let's go to Roland from Eau Claire. Hi, Roland.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm sorry there's an echo here this morning, but we're hearing you. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was interested in your program. I was...
Do you have your radio on?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just keep talking.
Okay. The other day in Eau Claire, I was standing on some Cambrian rock, and I was thinking of what it was like half a billion years ago when life was incubating in the seas around here. And I was thinking about how what Stephen Jay Gould one time said, that if we could run our clocks back to the Cambrian period and run it forward, the chances of humans appearing would only be a million and one. And then I was thinking that, there have been mass extinctions, and that the universe is not a place really for life in general. Extinctions happen. There's not a whole lot we can do about it. And that universe is pretty much indifferent to life. We're here for a cosmic moment, and then something wipes us out. It could be a gamma ray burst. It could be an asteroid collision. It could be any number of things. And I think that's a good way to look at the universe, as something which is extensive and expansive, but it doesn't require a human presence. We need the universe to exist, but the universe doesn't need us. I don't know if I'm making...
Yeah, you're making sense, Elizabeth.
Well, that's certainly to take a cosmic view of things. I think, on some level, that's undeniable. You know, most of the universe is probably devoid of life, as the caller points out. We've yet to see signs of life anywhere else. On the other hand, life is quite tenacious. It did arise here, on some level by chance, clearly, and as the caller pointed out, survived perhaps by chance. But it's pretty robust, and we have survived some pretty massive change over the last, three billion years. So I think life itself is very resilient. It may not take the form, that we recognize now. I can't tell you what the future of life is going to be. But I don't think life itself, barring some true cosmic, disaster, is in danger any time soon.
Thanks very much for the call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Ray from Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest.
Morning, Ray.
About every 65 million years, we have a mass extinction, and aren't we about due for one within the next, let's say, million years or so? Because it's been 65 million years since the last one. And then the second question is about the mini ice ages, which come every 10,000 years. And we're about due for another one of those. If you look at the record, it was about 10,000 years ago that we had a mini ice age, and Chicago was under a mile and a half of ice.
Well, I think that, there's no great regularity to mass extinctions, and that has confounded people. In fact, they've gone out and looked for some kind of periodicity, I guess scientists would call it. So every X number of million years, that one of these things happened. Did it have to do with being, in some kind of collision course with an asteroid in that period? People had all sorts of theories, but in fact, when they really went to look at it, they found, well, the period, there was no clear periodicity, and these things didn't seem to be being caused in a regular way by impacts, let's say. So we don't really, as I point out in the piece, we don't really have a theory of mass extinction. We don't know why they happen sort of at these irregular intervals. Is it just sort of a chance occurrence? So I don't think anyone would say we're due for mass extinction. I just don't think that scientists would think that the phenomenon has a regularity like that. Now, in terms of ice ages, I think what you're talking about is not mini ice ages, but genuine ice ages, where we have these glacial cycles for the last 2 million years or so, where the ice sheets expand and then they contract, and we are in what's called an interglacial period right now. And in the normal course of events, if human beings were not around, if we had not pumped a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it's possible, once again, the periodicity of these things is somewhat unclear exactly. There are longer interglacials and sometimes shorter interglacials, so we don't know that we would be, you know, heading into an ice age under normal circumstances. But I think it's generally agreed that there's way too much CO2 in the atmosphere right now to get an ice age, and we, you know, have to worry about precisely the opposite effect, that we're going into a very different climate regime that the world has actually not seen for a long time, potentially ice-free, where the world is ice-free, which has happened, you know, many times in history. The real problem with that is that, as far as humans are concerned, is that sea level will rise very dramatically if that happens. So that's, you know, one of the reasons people are so concerned about carbon emissions right now. We're actually pushing the world into a very different climate cycle.
And you talk about how fast that may be happening. What did paleontologists and other scientists that you spoke with have to say about the rapidity of the climate change?
Well, I think that one of the things that people have speculated when they look back at the record, there was a very, very massive extinction. It came as close as we know of anything to genuinely wiping out life on Earth about 251 million years ago. It's called, you know, the end Permian extinction, and that might have been caused by a huge burst of CO2 into the atmosphere that caused massive warming and massive changes in the oceans, and that we are, you know, getting way too close. I don't necessarily think anyone thinks we're repeating the end Permian, but that we are doing the sorts of things, the same sorts of things, pumping CO2 into the air at a rate that, you know, in natural terms is very, very high, and that we're going to be causing changes way, way faster than the natural world can adjust to them. I mean, that's clear that that's happening, you know, to a certain extent already.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to, thanks very much, Ray, for the call. Mike from Green Bay. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment on this is more of a concerns and attitude of humans in general toward their position on the planet, such as, you know, you can either look at it as I'm part of this Earth community, I'm part of the community in general, and wish to add to the community, or I'm here for myself. We're all going to be gone at some point in time. It doesn't make any difference. And my opinion, and I understand the universe doesn't need us, my opinion is that we are capable of making changes and affecting the environment around us. We could do it in a positive way. We could use our skills, our intellectual skills, to actually change our behaviors that in such a way that they don't negatively affect our environment. The others that are interfering or unwilling to go along, you know, the sooner, as harsh as this sounds, as they leave the earth, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Elizabeth, are we capable of making changes here and need to do so quickly?
Well, I certainly think we need to. I think we need to do so quickly, and I think we're capable in theory of making changes. Are we capable in fact? You know, that's going to be the question of the century, I think. We're increasingly going to bump up against that question.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the bats for a moment. Some of the more dramatic pieces in the book are when you go into that cave, and oh man, I could just see it so vividly. A couple questions. The purpose of bats, the purpose of so many different kinds of bats on the planet, I think that you wrote at one point that of all living creatures, one-fifth are bats. Why do we have so many bats? What purpose do they serve, and what does it mean that they're dying off so rapidly?
Well, one-fifth of all mammals.
Mammals.
All species of mammals are bats. Yes, bats are very, very widespread, very widespread. They're great colonizers, as you can imagine, because they can fly long distances, and they are very, very adaptable. They have proved very adaptable So there are all sorts of different kinds of bats. They have all sorts of different ways of living, and they occupy, you know, different ecological niches. So, you know, I mean, there's no, I guess I will betray my own, you know, cosmic view here and say there's no purpose to that. It's just how evolution has worked. You know, a lot of evolution is a roll of the dice, as the caller before pointed out. You know, you could change, have run evolution, Stephen Jay Gould's famous line, you could run evolution, you know, very, very differently, and you'd end up with a very different world. So there's a lot of chance involved. But bats right now, at this particular moment, are very plentiful, widespread, and their loss will probably, you know, ramify through ecosystems. They eat a lot of insects. You know, a single sort of, you know, bat colony or whatever can eat, you know, billions of insects in a very short amount of time. Some bats, now these are not necessarily the bats that are dying off right now, some bats are pollinators. So if they were to be affected, then that would be very serious for the, you know, plants that they pollinate. So, you know, we don't know when you pull out one of the strands of an ecological community, we don't know exactly what happens. But it seems likely, especially with species that are so common, as like the little brown bat, which is the most common bat species up here in the Northeast and throughout the U.S., which is being very seriously affected by this fungus. We don't know what the effect of that will be of pulling, if you were to actually pull that species out of the ecosystem, just drive it to extinction. But, you know, it could quite possibly be serious for many other species.
Mm-hmm. And what about the frogs?
Well, likewise, you know, if you kill off the frogs, which are, you know, doubtless a food source, every, you know, what we learn in grade school, that every organism is part of a food web. There are food sources for certain other organisms. They eat certain other organisms. So things have evolved so that they're not static. You know, the world is never static, but so that things are, you know, I guess to use a cliche, sort of in balance, so that the different species, even as their populations rise and fall over time, they have figured out a way, you know, evolutionarily to survive, to live together. And you pull something out of that, once again, you just don't know. You don't know how that will reverberate through the system. Some, in a lot of cases, there's a lot of redundancy in the system. So the system may move on, you know, essentially unchanged, except for the, you know, sad loss of these species. But in some cases, you will pull out, you know, organisms that are important to other organisms, and so therefore you will have this sort of cascading effect. And that's very difficult to predict.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about once mass extinction occurs, that it takes millions of years for life to recover, and when it does, it generally has a new cast of characters. What an interesting thing to contemplate.
Well, that is very vividly illustrated by the extinction 65 million years ago, which was a very large extinction event and killed off most organisms, you know, most large organisms, including our, you know, our friends the dinosaurs, to kill off the dinosaurs, which were the dominant land organism for many, many millions of years. That's a big extinction. And what happened, what we can tell from the fossil record, is that, you know, the diversity of life was severely diminished for a long time. It took a long time for these the remaining organisms that somehow survived, many of, you know, some of which were our own, you know, ancestors, became primates, became hominids, became humans, to radiate out into the sort of ecological niches that the dinosaurs had occupied. So mammals became the dominant land animals after that extinction. Now, what would have happened to mammals had that extinction not taken place? Well, you know, presumably, once again, no one can know, but presumably they would have remained these little creatures, you know, rustling through the legs of the dinosaurs. But, you know, this extinction sort of cleared the stage, and different organisms took over, you know, once the dinosaurs were gone.
More phone calls for Elizabeth in just one moment. We're talking about her article appearing in this week's New Yorker magazine, and a fascinating one it is, the sixth extinction. There have been five great die-offs in history. This time the cataclysm is us. And she talks about those other extinctions and talks about a rapid disappearance of frogs, and also dramatic stories about the deaths of tens of thousands of bats. Here's our number again. Join us if you'd like. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, the email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Gurian is with us the second hour of our program today. His latest book is The Purpose of Boys, Helping Our Sons Find Meaning, Significance, and Direction in Their Lives. Back to phone calls for Elizabeth. And the number is 800-486-8655. Elizabeth Colbert has been a staff writer on The New Yorker since 1999. She's done a great deal of work on climate change, three-part series on global warming, The Climate of Man, which won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, and a number of other awards, including the American Association for the Advancement of Science Journalism Award. All right, let's go to Bill from Oshkosh next. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for this great show. My question is, and a comment, why does it take so long for these issues to get before government and national authorities or even state authorities? And Wisconsin has adopted some natural growth areas around its lakes to prevent, you know, super runoff. And although that won't help the frogs, at least it won't damage the habitat they once lived in. But in the early 1980s, the University of Wisconsin's ecology group was doing research on this very topic, and I'm wondering if the author and her, you know, journeys through the academia and research have discovered efforts in other states, because, well, where would we be without the moral example of toad and wind in the willows? I mean, our children will look at it and say, huh?
Right.
Yeah, well, you know, the question of why does it take so long, you know, when you're in the midst of these things and they're sort of happening piecemeal, they you know, seem to be just part of this sort of noise. We've certainly, you know, been aware that we have an extinction crisis for a long time. We have the Endangered Species Act, but, you know, the question of there's so many different ways right now in which we're impacting the Earth and potentially causing extinction, that it's very hard to control at this point. And you know, the point about toad and haw is a very, very real one and a very, very sad one. You know, when I was out with some of these people at the bat colonies, and to be honest, I have not yet seen, I found it a very personal story, a dead bat in our barn. We have a barn, and I found a bat that I guess probably had died of this syndrome over the winter, and we usually have bats in our barn. And they have not arrived yet this spring. I keep being hopeful that they will still arrive. But, you know, it does hit you very close to home in some ways. You know, when you look out on a summer night and there are no bats, even people who, you know, might not care for bats, it's, when you think about it, it's very sad. Will our children just have a world that's just, you know, really denuded of just very basic, you know, animals that we grew up with frogs and bats. It's pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. And you do mention the university. I can't remember the context of the study that was going on, but you mentioned UW-Madison in your article.
Well, it wasn't UW-Madison. It's the National Wildlife, USGS has a lab.
Oh, okay.
In Madison, where they have done a lot of these frog, not frog, I'm sorry, bat studies, and trying to figure out what's going on, and they've done a lot of important work there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bill, for your call. We go next to Eileen from Ladysmith. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. My interest has been the toads that I've watched in Bayfield, Wisconsin. I'm from Ladysmith, but we sail in Bayfield, and about 12 to 15 years ago, I would find these huge toads sitting in front of a water dispensing machine or Coke machine, and I would watch them, and then in the evening when they would be sitting there looking for the bugs, and then I couldn't find them in the daytime, it created a children's story for me, a poem about this. But as this poem became a book, I became more aware that I couldn't find those toads any longer up in Bayfield, and I was surprised at that because I think toads are a hardier bunch than their cousins, the frogs, and yet I don't see any toads where we sail any longer.
Well, I can't, answer the specifics of why you're not seeing any toads, but definitely there have been population crashes here in the U.S., some, probably related to this fungus, which is definitely in the U.S., and some related to, it doesn't take that much. Frogs and toads have, many of them have very specific requirements for reproducing. And, if you take a stream, let's say, or a pond, which is crucial for them, and you change it, you change the water quality, you change the flow, you simply, dam up the stream or whatever, they're just not going to be there anymore. So it can be very specific to the place, or it could be part of this wider phenomenon. I just can't answer that.
I'm particularly concerned because as this marina area changed, they began to groom it more carefully, and there were no dandelions.
It's clear, it's pretty clear that certain agricultural chemicals have been linked to these, really grotesque frog deformities. That atrazine, a chemical that's very widely applied in agricultural settings, is really not good for frogs. So when you think about it, of course it makes sense. These animals that have this very permeable skin that lay their eggs in the water, they're very sensitive to water quality, and we are very, very lax about things like that, and we're just not, in many cases, paying attention. So it's a very sad story, and people who study amphibians, which are survivors, in an evolutionary sense, amphibians have been around for a really long time, are very depressed. They're just very depressed about it.
Hmm. Well, thank you for your comments.
Thank you very much for the call. They've been around, I think you say, for 400 million years.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a long time.
Creatures of today's amphibians are among the first, creatures that crawled out of the water. I mean, they really are a link, to the sort of aquatic realm from which all life on Earth really arose.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to this fungus thing for a moment. I'm wondering, it seems to me as though if bats and frogs are affected by this, that other species would be as well. And it also points to a real danger. I know that species not native to certain countries are coming in via boats, shipping, airplanes, et cetera, all of that. What do we learn from that, and what else might be threatened here?
Well, the problem of invasive species, which on some level these diseases are, they're just, species that got transported, probably by humans from one part of the globe where they were sort of under control to another part where they had no natural enemies of their own and where they hit species that were unable to deal with them. That's being repeated every day around the world just by, as you say, shipping. The zebra mussel problem, which I'm sure you have in Wisconsin, came in, on cargo boats and now has just taken over many, ecosystems where they never were meant to be, and once again just displaced native species are a huge problem. Now people will point out that most species that you take around the world, they can't survive. They just, they're not suited to the climate, they're not suited to the environment, they don't have any food, they will just die. But a certain number of them will survive and go on to wreak havoc. And, people know the names of some of them. Kudzu is not
right.
Native to the U.S. There are many cases. There are many cases of non-native species, too, I should point out, that we consider very, very benign. Queen Anne's lace or whatever. These are also not native to the U.S. But some of them have been here so long we think of them as native. But they probably, in their own time, also displaced native plants. So, our landscape has been very, very much changed by things that were imported on purpose and things that were imported accidentally.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do about all of it now, Elizabeth?
Well, I really, to be honest, avoided that.
I know.
In my story, and quite purposefully, because I, you know, people have come up with very, you know, laudable plans to try to make, you know, sort of migration corridors. One of the things that's happening now is that you've set aside habitat for certain, you know, endangered animals. And in some cases, we've even done a pretty good job of that. But, you know, as the climate changes, they are not going to want to sit in these places that we have laid out for them. They're going to need to move as their food sources move, et cetera, so that you need to have these corridors throughout the world where organisms that are preserved so that animals can actually start moving with the climate. Now, that's a huge task. And, you know, people have, as I say, laid out sort of plans for that. I certainly think that's a very, very good idea. But the world is changing in a lot of ways that we can't even predict. So it's very, very hard, you know, to make arrangements for that if you can't even predict it at this point. And, you know, the changes are occurring on a very massive scale. We're changing the chemistry of the ocean by pouring CO2 into the air. A lot of it ends up in the oceans. We know that. That's just a basic fact. We know that the ocean, our chemistry is changing, that we're becoming more acidic. That's going to have really big impacts on corals. Corals are very threatened. Millions of organisms are potentially live on coral reefs. As people know, they're really hot spots of biodiversity. So, you know, these changes that we've set in motion, some of them have been sort of ineluctably set in motion, and it's very, very hard to come up with ways to reverse them. The best we can do in some cases is you know, stop doing what we're doing. You know, stop pouring CO2 into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Stop cutting down the rainforest. I mean, we know on some level what we need to do, but we have proved incapable of doing that.
Mm-hmm. You know, as one of the callers said earlier, this is very big news, and it's pretty astounding to me that we don't all know this, and things could be disappearing from the planet and are disappearing from the planet, and there's not a lot of public attention paid to all of this.
I mean, well, I think that, you know, the notion of extinction and a huge, you know, mass extinction or a spasm of extinction, whatever you want to call it, it sort of made news, you know, for a while when the term biodiversity was coined. That's only a term that's, you know, from the 1980s. And then it sort of faded into, you know, where big disastrous ideas often sort of fade out of mind. Mm-hmm. But it's very much with us. It's very much with us, and it is, you know, completely irreversible. You drive a species to extinction, you are not getting that species back ever.
Right.
Ever.
Yeah.
And so it's a huge, huge impact that we're having on the planet in that way.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the depth of your article, too. You don't just write an article. You write an article that requires a phenomenal amount of research.
Well, it was really interesting to do all that research. I mean, a lot of it, you know, I myself did not know. And so there's just a lot of really fascinating work that's been done in this field. And there's a fascinating natural history here and the history of science. So it was actually really interesting to read a lot of that.
Yeah, I would imagine. And what made you, was it an offshoot of the wonderful work you've done on climate change, or what prompted this?
Well, I think it was also part of, you know, part of it was certainly climate change. What are the impacts of climate change? And this is a big one, a really biggie. But then it was just also, as you say, the sense that, well, this issue just isn't getting any attention, you know, and it's a huge one. So let's try to get it some attention.
Mm-hmm. And when did you say the bats normally come to your barn?
Well, you know, to be really frank, I don't keep track of it. They're just sort of there, you know. And now that I've been made
right,
you know, conscious, and there's always bat poop all over the barn too, I should add. So I've just been going out to the barn to check and see, you know, well, is anyone there? And this is the season in the Northeast, so by May they are definitely out of hibernation. They should be here. But so far, not anyone.
Hmm. That must have been such a horrendous sight to see all of those thousands of bats gone.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, it really brings it home to you, because extinction, you know, in a lot of ways, it's an absence. So it's just something's not there.
Right.
But when you see, you know, what it really means in terms of mortality, it's very, you know, horrifying.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the article. It was important and so well done. Thanks, Elizabeth, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Elizabeth Colbert, our guest. The article is well worth reading. It's in the current issue of The New Yorker magazine. You can get it online, too, in case you don't get The New Yorker. Just go, Google New Yorker, and you'll find her article. I'm trying to get the exact name of the article. I always have so many papers, I lose track of where we are. The article is titled The Sixth Extinction. There have been five great die-offs in history, and this time the cataclysm is us. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, has been for some 10 years, and has won all kinds of awards for her series on global warming, The Climate of Man. She is the author of several books, and we're very pleased to have had her with us this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up in just a moment and return with more Wednesday morning conversation. So I hope you'll join us for that. But in just a few moments, we'll have the news coming up. Thanks for your calls as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10 o'clock, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.